Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Going for your first ever run around the park. Literally running errands all over town. Running for the finish line and your personal best. If you run, you're a runner. Find the shoes and clothes to run your way at newbalance.com/running. New Balance. Run your way.
What does Colgate mean by live life to the brightest? Could it be a rich glass of red sipped inside a Parisian cafe on a snowy night when my gaze is met by a tall, mysterious... I mean, brushing is directed with Colgate Optic White Pro Series Toothpaste gives you a visibly whiter smile in just 3 days, so you can live life to the brightest and finish that glass without worrying about teeth stains. Colgate Optic White. Find it at all major retailers.
There is a breathless hush in the close tonight. 10 to make and the match to win. A bumping pitch and a blinding light. An hour to play and the last man in. And it's not for the sake of a ribboned coat or the selfish hope of a season's fame, but his captain's hand on his shoulder smote. Play up, and play the game.
Oh,
Tom Holland. I could see your lip curling in a metropolitan sneer.
I'm wiping away a manly tear.
So that is Vitae Lampada by Sir Henry Newbolt. The great poem of empire, isn't it? And the great one of the great poems of cricket. Much it derided, is. I think, in the 21st century. But definitely a favourite poem in the Sandbrook household.
I'm so glad to hear that, Dominic. Very much a favourite poem in the Holland household as well. I read it to my daughters every evening.
And do they laugh?
They do. So we're doing today's episode is on cricket, which is obviously something I've been wanting to do for ages and ages and ages. And the excuse for that is that this episode is going out midway through the first test match in the Ashes series between England and Australia. And I'm aware that we will have lots of listeners who will have no idea what we're going on about, who will have no interest in cricket, no knowledge of it at all.
If you're an American, that's just babble.
Yeah. So what I would just by explanation, the Ashes is the kind of the oldest international ongoing contest in cricket between England and Australia. And it's the kind of centerpiece of every English cricket fan's obsession. But I think also it's legitimate to look at cricket because I think, you know, just we did football, didn't we?
We
did the Olympics. And I think sport is a fascinating topic for historical inquiry, whether you have any interest in it or not.
It is absolutely, Tom. I mean, as you know, I'm not a great cricket fan, but cricket has been an important part of English national identity. And as that poem suggests, because that poem goes on, the later verses have a scene in the Sudan. A battle in the Sudan. So cricket is kind of woven into Britain's
sense of its... That's the one with the Gatling jammed, isn't it?
The Gatling's jammed and the
blood
squares,
is spilling.
Blood seeping into it. It's brilliant. And a voice pipes up, play up and play the game. And it's presumably the same fellow who was playing cricket at Cheltenham. Yeah. I think it's set at Cheltenham. Anyway, it's
which
sort of
a reminder that also it's not just about England. Of course, it's also about empire.
Exactly.
It's about the aftermath
exactly.
of empire. And
exactly. And the reason that, of course, people play cricket in India and Australia, as we will discover in this podcast, is because of the empire. But I feel that even with your mighty mind and your great knowledge of cricket, we need a guest. Am I right?
We do, and we need a top writer on cricket. I would say the top writer on cricket in England. And it is my friend and teammate in the authors, the team that I play cricket with, John Houghton. who writes this fantastic blog called The Old Batsman. He co-wrote a film called Death of a Gentleman, which was an absolute evisceration of contemporary international cricket administrators. It's an absolutely brilliant film. And he wrote a book very modestly titled The Meaning of Cricket.
That's good.
Yeah. So John knows the meaning of cricket. And John, you're currently, you're collaborating on a book with Sir Geoffrey Boycott, who is a name that will mean a great deal to people who have any interest in cricket. Will mean absolutely nothing to loads of our listeners. So that's something we've got to remember right the way through. So, we've got a question here from Judith Downey. Is it possible for a conversation about cricket to hold my interest for the time span of a podcast? And I hope so, because cricket is a really, really fascinating mirror held up to all kinds of historical, cultural, social trends, isn't it?
You would say so, yes. I mean, it's a question that gets asked quite often, I think, that question, why should I be interested in cricket? Because it has this kind of weirdly high bar to entry, you know. It's not, there's a great story from Martin Amis when he was writing London Fields. And there's a character in it called Keith Tallant, who's one of his sort of evil dwarf type characters.
Plays darts.
They're all evil dwarves in Martin Amis.
He said he wanted, he knew the character wanted to be involved in a sport. He had to play some sort of sport. And he first considered snooker, but then he chose darts. And the reason he chose darts was that he said, you can tell anyone everything they need to know about darts in 5 minutes. Right, which is kind of cruel, but it's really true. There's no hinterland in darts. There's no kind of post-match technical analysis of a darts match. You know, you just chuck things at a board. Cricket is a sort of diametric opposite to that. You know, it's a game that exists in the imagination and through time. And if you don't have either of those things to give to it, I think this will be very difficult for you, because it's archaic, it's arcane, it's hard to understand, and I've done a really good job in selling it.
Yeah, you have. So, well, are there any listeners left?
Well, there's a question from Thad Will. Question from the USA. Please explain, as you would for a child, how this game is played. We have no clue. Now, this is not a sports podcast, so we're not going to go into all that, but I would say at its most basic, actually, it's very simple. It's a bloke chucking a ball. And somebody tries to hit it.
Trying to hit it, yes. I mean,
it could be baseball. In a way, it's kind of hockey and golf. I mean, they all kind of, you know, it's a stick and you try and hit a ball. So if we're looking at where cricket comes from, how it originates, how it emerges in England when it does, where does cricket begin? Well, and this is a much mythologized issue, is it not?
It really is, yes. I even saw a quote today from John Major, who is a cricket obsessive former Prime Minister.
Cricket historian himself.
Cricket historian. He wrote a very good book about the history of cricket. And he said it's a bit like searching for the Holy Grail. You will never find it. You will never find the origins of cricket. WG, cricket's most famous player, he claimed it originated from quoits.
But what century do you think we're talking about? 16th, 17th, 18th?
Well, Dominic.
Oh, don't tell me to go back even further.
Shall I tell you what the...
he's been dying to tell this story.
What an Armenian professor, Dr. Abraham Terian, thinks it came from, and who the first person to play it was.
No, don't.
I'm going to tell you.
Go on, go on.
Do you know who it was?
There you are.
Is it a big name?
It is.
Is it an Armenian king?
No, it's
Is it Artavasdes II?
No, Dominic, it's Jesus.
Jesus played cricket.
So he found
what?
He found in the manuscript library of the Armenian Patriarchate of Jerusalem.
Yeah.
An 8th century copy of a much earlier gospel, which described the infancy of Jesus. And in this gospel, Jesus is described as playing something faintly similar to cricket. i.e. people throwing balls and he's hitting it. And the catch is that Jesus, when he chases the ball, can run onto the sea. Thereby.
Well, did we not discuss in a previous podcast about how Piltdown Man had a cricket bat or something like that, an ancient cricket bat?
Yes. So that's the kind of classic example of the way in which people can kind of back project and create myths around it. I mean, I think obviously Jesus didn't play cricket. Obviously this wasn't cricket. And there have been all kinds of attempts to to kind of trace its origins beyond England. So there's the
surely people are now claiming it's invented in China or something, are they?
Well, Belgium is a very popular.
Belgium?
Criquet.
Right. Yeah. Tintin was a great cricketer.
Yeah, and there's
and Hercule Poirot.
An 8th century monk saw a sport with a bat and ball being played in Florence.
Okay.
There's a 12th century poet says that young men in England enjoy a game called cricks. There's a clerk in the reign of Edward I who complained that the Prince of Wales, so future Edward II, was passionate about a game called criag.
Okay. They sound very implausible to me, to be honest. I mean,
yeah, I think they are implausible. Aren't they?
But yeah. John, were people playing cricket? Are people playing cricket, let's say, in the Civil War? Do you think?
Yes. You would say a recognisable version of what becomes cricket. Yes, but cricket, it's one of those things. It has many roots, many origins. It had many forms. It wasn't really, and I suppose until Grace came along. And, you know, his first season was in 1864, a very kind of significant time for cricket because it was the first season that overarm bowling was legalised, for example. It was the year the first Wisden came out.
Wisden is the almanac that comes out and gives you all the details every year.
You know, there's one of cricket's great hinterlands is its statistical meaning and the way it's recorded. And so at that point, cricket was recognisably cricket. Before then, there'd been lots of different versions of cricket. So small-sided games, you know, you had famous games where you'd have a farmer and his dog playing against a bloke up the road in the village. And they'd be playing a version of cricket, you know. Generally in those tales, one of them drops down dead because the dog is a brilliant fielder and no one can score a run, you know. So there's lots of those kind of origin style myths. But the amazing thing, I suppose the thing to say is the root of the game as we know it would probably come from two places. And I would say one of them is the measurement of the pitch, of the area of ground that it's played on. And the measure of a cricket pitch is 22 yards.
And when is that decided?
And that comes from Thomas Gunter's chain, which you may or may not have heard of. You know, it was a way of measuring land. He came up with a way of measuring land using a physical chain that was 66 links or 22 yards long.
And when was that?
And that was used as the base of the length of the field. I think Gunter's chain. I'd have to look it up. I'm not a historian who immediately recalls the dates. I will look it up for you now. But keep
this is
talking.
Brilliant. This is live. This is live action.
Live research.
live research.
Yeah. But the amazing thing is, it has never changed. It's never changed from that. Everyone being able to lay down this chain and say that's how long a pitch is.
I've looked it up. It's 1620.
1620.
So the
amazing thing about 22 yards is that it has contained the whole game ever since. Which is an astonishing thing. And anyone can play on it. You know, whether you're 5'3", a real little short ass, or whether you're 6'10", you can compete equally on this distance. And unlike sort of golf courses or tennis balls or anything like that, it's never changed.
So, John, people who are playing it. So England is a very, very rural society at this point. The town's pretty small. I mean, they're expanding. So you obviously need quite a lot of space, but there is a lot of space. So basically it's a village game rather than a town game, is it?
Yeah. I mean, this is, again, goes back to this Victorian shaping of the sport. Before Victorians made it what we know as cricket today, it would be, you know, tiny little games played in hamlets and villages. It was a country sport for working class people. It wasn't this thing that it would become.
And Puritans are actually complaining, aren't they, if people are playing it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a sort of around where I live, which is on the Surrey-Hampshire borders, there's a lot of this sort of origin stories of the game. There's a village called Wrecklesham, who I did play cricket for in my youth. And there was a story that Wrecklesham, it's had something like five pubs within its village boundaries and was a kind of a place known for bad behaviour on a Sunday. People would go to the pubs on a Sunday and then play cricket. And cricket was this kind of, you know, almost a roguish, terrible thing to do.
So at that point, people are playing just on their one day off, basically, are they? I mean, there aren't multi-day because they're working the fields and stuff.
No, yeah, and also the game, although it had its 22 yards, it couldn't go on for long enough. It was too difficult to play in those days. I mean, the reason cricket lasts for a long time now is that people have got very good at it. Before then, I mean, you know, the games would be quite low scoring and quite quick.
Because the pitches are kind of rough. Because
the pitches don't exist. They're just in the middle of a field. I mean, they used to be. Okay. Cricket starts. All cricket matches start now with the toss of a coin. So the two teams can decide who's going to bat and who's going to bowl. Very, very early, the winner of the toss got to decide where the pitch would be.
That's good.
So,
that's great.
So, yeah. So they would walk into a field and toss a coin. And then the winning captain could select where in the field he would put the pitch.
And we've got a question from Nathan Hogg, which actually we should ask. So Nathan Hogg says, where did cricket get its name from? Because it is kind of a weird name. I mean, football makes sense, rugby obviously because of the school, but why cricket?
Yes, I mean, all these things like cricks and creag and quoits was WG's suggestion. Yeah, who knows? I don't know.
And that is part of the mystery of it, isn't it? Again, like football in a way, you know, all kinds of different versions of football were played through the Middle Ages, right the way up to the Victorian period. And you keep talking about the Victorian period, that this is where it gets regularized. This is where laws get introduced, where kind of standardization happens. But before that, again, you're kind of saying that there are all these different versions of it that have been played in different villages, in different counties. I mean, is that right? That basically it's in the south to begin with, but then also it starts to spread up to Yorkshire and places like that.
Well, here we go. I mean, we kind of tend to think of it as having begun in the south because that's where it's first recorded. I mean, there's in deepest Hampshire, there's a village called Hambledon, which is considered to be the cradle of the game. There's a pitch there called Broad Halfpenny Down, and that's where the game's thought to have started. But the only reason people think it started there is because that was where it was first written down, really. So the son of the publican, obviously the pitch was opposite a pub. There's a great tie in always between cricket and alcohol, certainly in England, cricket and drinking, both amongst the players and the spectators. But the son of the publican, John Nyren, began to write down the stories of the cricketers he'd seen in his youth. He called it Cricketers of Our Time. And those were the first cricketers we really know about and the first matches we really know about in any depth. And so people tend to think, well, that's where the game started. Whether there was another village in Yorkshire where exactly the same thing was happening, but no one wrote it down, who knows?
And what's interesting then is that you've got this kind of rural game and it's played among people who are not necessarily upper class at all. I mean, often labourers, the opposite of it. But at the same time, certainly in the 18th century, you're starting to get very, very posh people. I mean, including even the Prince of Wales starting to become obsessed by it too. And we've got a question from Dan Jackson, friend of the show, Northumbrian. Would you agree that cricket is arguably the least class-based sport in England, played and watched by everyone, certainly in comparison to football and rugby? I mean, I guess maybe that's changed with football now. But that sense that cricket is a sport that is played both by agricultural labourers and by dukes, does make it kind of distinctive, doesn't it?
Well, it does, yeah. I mean, I think it goes back to this notion of time again. You know, there were huge chunks of time that the aristocracy and the wealthier men had to fill in. I mean, what did you do all day? If you were rich, what did you do all day? You had to do something. So cricket kind of becomes tied up with other things like hunting and boxing. There was great rage for the gentlemen to be able to box at one point, you know, fighting in the streets. All of these, it becomes tied up with these other leisure pursuits as something to do. Horse racing, you know, you had to fill your time. So you had these kind of patrons emerging who would go and literally patronise the good cricketers in their area, give
and
them
also
money
it lends
to play
itself
cricket
to gambling,
for their
teams. Doesn't it? It lends itself
very,
to gambling.
Very much, yeah. And it lends itself to a day out. I mean, it's a relatively slow-moving sport. You can stand there and have a chat with people and turn around and not much has happened in the meantime. You probably haven't missed anything. And it just became a kind of very, very nice day out, really, a summer's day out.
So at what point, if you had to, I know the records are very hazy and it's all kind of in the murk of time, but if you had to pinpoint a time when people went to watch cricket,
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah.
When are people going in sort of decent numbers, i.e. not just to watch their family member play, but to watch a game?
Well, I mean, cricket has a great, has always had a long ongoing relationship with novelty. It loves novelty. It loves to reinvent itself. Although it has this sort of pastoral image as something unchanging. In fact, it's a game that is constantly reinventing itself. So as the sort of, I suppose the, you'd say the Regency era, the fancy, you know, as they start to go to games to fill in time, they want these kind of novelty events to happen that they can watch. So you had games, certainly in the Regency era, after the Napoleonic Wars, you had games where you'd have a team of men with one arm against a team of men with one leg.
That sounds brilliant. How could the men with one leg run? I mean,
well, that's all part of the fun of it.
It was called something like a grotesque spectacle or something. but they were all veterans of it. They were mostly guys living in, I suppose, arms, old accommodation given to ex-Navy personnel.
The aptly named almshouses.
Almshouses, yeah. there's a really famous scorecard, and I've always wondered whether this was where they got the name from, where the number 11 for the one-legged team was called Baldrick. seriously, and he was run out twice for naught. so they were given the game lasted for 2 days and they were overnight, they were fed on ale and meat and all of this tremendous impossible to digest stuff, and it just became so. And then you had games like married versus single, you had games like 13 stone versus under 13 stone.
More of that. Yeah, they're definitely
in a way that is what they do. That in a way, with the reinvention of cricket with new formats like 2020 cricket and those sort of things, that's the modern equivalent of what that was.
Well, so there's a really interesting question here from David Davis, who says, I often hear complaints that modern cricket is dumbing down the great game's tradition. So talking about 2020, whatever. However, I do feel the 2020, the IPL, gambling, money, etc., is much closer to its Georgian roots in the public school Victorian morality of early 20th century cricket. Do you agree? So that's focusing in on what is quite an interesting pivot in the history of cricket, that you do have this kind of buccaneering Regency sense where they're all playing one-legged, gambling on it, and all that kind of stuff, and getting drunk and all kinds of things. And then with the Victorian period, that's where you start to get ideas of it not being cricket.
Yes.
Am I oversimplifying?
No, I don't think so. I think the Victorians were the ones who imposed this moral sense on the game. So before the Victorians did that, it was a game for rogues. There was a lot of cheating. There was a lot of gambling. There was a lot of match fixing. And so the Victorians came along, and I suppose with their general culture thought, well, we can't have that. Actually, here's a game that can be a vision of England. And as the Victorians do that, you get this great star emerging, the first famous cricketer, really, in W.G. Grace. And he comes along because...
So he's a huge man with a big beard.
A big man with a big beard.
And maybe even people who know nothing about cricket may have a sense of him.
Well, this is the interesting thing, is that he is probably still today more famous than some of the people in the England cricket team. And this is the resonance. His image is kind of carried with it down the years.
Well, John, you say that he's the most famous cricketer. I mean, in a way, he's the most famous person
in Victorian England. He's the first
great celebrity, isn't he?
He is. He is. Yeah. He's the first celebrity, and of course, it goes to his head and to his gut. I mean, he comes from a small village called Downend outside of Bristol. He's got a very high-pitched, squeaky voice.
Like a Neanderthal, yes.
He's thought of as a slight figure of fun. They look down their noses at him. But he is a genius at this game. He's a huge man. First of all, he's sort of 6'3". He gets bigger and bigger as he eats and drinks more and more and becomes more of a star. But you compare this to Victorian England when everyone was a short ass. It would be like us looking at Tyson Fury. An enormous man with a big beard. Even if you see pictures of him when he was 18 and made his sort of fabulous breakthrough season in 1866, when he plays the innings that comes to define modern cricket, the innings that people often say, if you could see one innings from cricket history, one moment, what would it be? Well, it would be WG as an 18-year-old at the Oval scoring 224 against Surrey for All England, because this innings changes everything. And he does it over 2 days.
Why does it change everything?
Well, he does it over 2 days. And what until WG came along, the contest between bat and ball, which is the pivotal contest in cricket, was always won by the ball. There was a WG himself said,
days.
Yeah, WG himself said, it was thought that if the bowling was good, all the batsman could do nothing about it. All he could do would keep it out. Well, I resolved to challenge that theory. And he begins with his great size and strength, whacking the ball in the air over the fielders. It becomes spectacular and amazing. And what he does really is he imagines a future. He changes the mindset of the game. And this is how the game always changes, with an act of imagination. And he's really the first one to do that. And the great thing is this is how much of an athlete he was before he became
a man of size.
In between this 2 day innings in the evening, he goes from the Oval to Crystal Palace and wins the 440 yard hurdles.
That is brilliant.
In his pink racing knickerbockers.
That's such Victorian behaviour.
So he was a bit of a lad, you know, but obviously a star. And as he becomes bigger and bigger, and you know, obviously the railways come along, the newspapers come along, and all of a sudden he can go around the country. He can play cricket all around the country. People can see him. When he gets to Australia for the first time, the docks at Melbourne are lined with people because they just want to see him.
And he gets sponsored, doesn't he? He gets sponsored by Coleman's Mustard.
He did get sponsored.
So at that point, you have record keeping of games.
Yeah, yeah.
So people know what his score is. You have crowds going. And do you have an organised national competition of any kind?
Yeah, I mean, that is emerging at exactly the same time. There isn't international cricket when WG comes along, but there is county cricket. Now, for those listening outside England, I suppose you define as county. I mean, Tom will give you chapter and verse on what is a county and what is a region and all of that stuff, because he yearns for the return of Wessex. But essentially, like, think of it like a state or, your local state.
Now, why? That's a puzzle to me, because football and rugby, I mean, they have clubs in big towns. So, you know, in football, it's obviously Manchester United, you know, or Wolves or whoever. In rugby, well, there's a shut up. Wolverhampton Wanderers is one of the founder members of the Football League, I'll have you know. Yeah. Right.
It's the one that comes to everyone's mind.
Of course it is. Of course it is, because it's got such an iconic history and an emblematic badge. I don't know what you're talking about. Rugby, you know, Bristol, Bath, I mean, they're all big. Their strength is in the West Country, but it's in towns or in Leicester or Gloucester or whatever. Why is cricket county? Why isn't it cities?
Yeah, well, I think just because it's slightly earlier. It's very slightly earlier. And counties were big enough to generate 11 or 22 or however many men you needed to form a team.
Right.
I would guess that's the reason.
And because of the rural roots, I suppose?
Yeah,
because
maybe the rural roots as well, yeah. But it just happens slightly earlier than those, you know, those football clubs you're talking about were, 1870, 1880.
Some of the top clubs, I think, were 1877, Tom.
So the counties in cricket are very slightly, 20 or 30 years earlier than that.
So, John, you mentioned Australia, and after the break, we should look at the spread of cricket around the world. But just one last thing on Victorian cricket and its growth. The phrase, it's not cricket, the kind of sentiments that were expressed in the poem with which Dominic opened
very
this
rousing
episode. The idea that playing cricket is somehow morally improving, that it's about sportsmanship, that it's about fair play.
That it has a moral dimension,
that is not a feature of the game when you've got all these kind of snuff-taking rakes who are gambling and paying one-legged men and so on. Where does this idea that, you know, you play up and play the game come
well,
from?
I don't know. I think I've always been really fascinated by that, because I think there is something in the seeds of the game that give you an idea of fairness. It's a contest between batsman and bowler, and the contest is somehow due to the dynamics of the game, the way it's scored, the length of the pitch and the equality between bat and ball.
Yeah.
There's somehow a kind of fairness within the sport. Whereas if you do your best and you're good at it, you will succeed.
But isn't there a counter argument to that, that you mentioned W.G. Grace, and he's the titanic figure in the history of cricket, really. But he's a notoriously bad sport. I mean, notorious for his gamesmanship.
Well, he's sort of, you know, there's the famous story about, you know, the guy, the Charles Courtright, the fast bowler, knocking two of W.G.'s three stumps out of the ground and saying to him, oh, going already, doctor, there's still one stump left. I mean, W.G. was, yes, you would say that. They've come to watch me bat, not you umpire, all that sort of thing. But still, I think, how would I say it? He's still governed by the framework of the game. He can't get away with everything. These things we're talking about, they might be close decisions. They might be, you know, I could have gone this way, it could have gone that way. So he exploited his fame and the laws in some way. But at the heart of the game is this contest that you might say gives it its fairness and its kind of moral quality, if there is one.
See, if I was being sceptical, Tom, and you won't like this.
I would say that
as cricket is eclipsed eventually or is rivaled by football, particularly for the hearts and minds of kind of the industrial, urban, working classes, then it becomes very important for cricket's sort of the Tom Holland figures to sanctify it as this pastoral, idealized.
Yeah.
What do you mean, Tom Holland figures? I don't sanctify it at all.
You do. You think it's. You probably think it's sacral. I mean, you haven't mentioned Christianity yet, but it's surely only moments away. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think Tom should mention Christianity because I think that whole notion of cricket as an upstanding moral force does come from the sort of muscular Christianity idea of health and vigor and fair play. Yeah, I think it very much comes from that.
But I mean, cricket is an industrial sport as well as a rural sport. I mean, that's the whole key to it. It's played, you know, in Leeds and in Manchester and in Birmingham, just as it's played in Somerset and Kent.
Not as well.
Well, I mean,
no, I'm joking.
I always remember the kind of blinding realization of why was it that football and cricket were played, you know, in industrial cities, whereas rugby wasn't. And the answer is that you can play cricket and football on cobbled hard stones.
Yeah.
You know, whereas rugby, you can't because you've got to kind of throw yourself on the ground.
On the ground,
so it's going to be incredibly painful. I think that, I mean, we've got on this question of how cricket kind of bridges divides. Another question from just Luke. Is cricket the ultimate metaphor for and symbol of British society, cutting across the class and north-south divides, the individual versus collective? And I think there is something to that. It was definitely something that the British in the 19th century felt very, very kind of sentimental about. And Dominic, you were like this. They contrasted it with France. So
what did they play? Pétanque.
Well, on the day the Bastille was stormed, the Earl of Winchelsea, who's a key figure, he's kind of behind the drawing up of the laws of cricket, the sponsorship of the Marylebone Cricket Club, which is the MCC ends up buying Lord's Cricket Ground, the most famous cricket ground in the world in London. He was playing in the Hampshire-Kent match at Hambledon, which John mentioned, and he gets clean bowled by an agricultural labourer called William Bullen.
This is on the day, the 14th of July or whatever.
On the 14th of July,
1789.
Yeah. And G.M. Trevelyan, the great historian, writing about this, observed, if the French nobility had been capable of playing cricket with their peasants, their chateau would never have been burnt.
Oh.
Rule Britannia.
That's a perfect place to take a break, isn't it?
I think it is. And I think when we come back, we should look at the ambivalent role that cricket has played in British imperial domination of the world and the way in which the colonized have used cricket to fight back. So we'll see you after the break.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh. How so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit. Or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at ikea-usa.com/circular. Visit ikea-usa.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
Yeah, you know you need protein to fuel results, but it's not easy when you're drinking the same bland, chalky shake every day. Stop punishing yourself and get to GNC for the best protein in the game, including all the hottest brands and crave-worthy flavors that'll keep you coming back for more. We're talking protein that legit tastes like cookies, your favorite cereals, indulgent desserts, and more. So bust out of your protein rut and actually look forward to those shakes with unbeatable protein at unbeatable prices. Fuel your fitness with protein at GNC.
Welcome back to The Rest Is History. Now, some of you may have heard a very exciting development, which is that we have been having so much fun doing this show that we have launched our very own community, The Rest Is History Club. You're very excited about this, aren't you, Tom?
I'm very excited about it.
And what do you get? You get, well, I'll tell you one thing you get. You get every episode with no ads, including all the old episodes.
So if you already signed up to it, you won't be listening to this.
The days of The Guardian, Saturday Supplement, of Beer 52, of all our tremendous sponsors. You'd be saying goodbye to all that, which is a bit of a wrench, I know.
However, but, yes. On top of that, you would also get an extra episode every week. It will go out on the Tuesday, and we'll be looking back at your comments, your thoughts, your feedback on the previous week's episodes.
Very, very much listener-led.
Very listener-led.
Yeah.
And we'll be doing one live-streamed episode every month on YouTube. And so we've got one coming up next Wednesday on the 15th of December. That's going to be on the 60s.
Yep, that's very exciting.
Membership of an exclusive chat room community, which hilariously is called Discord.
I don't think we chose that name, did we?
No, we didn't. We didn't. But we'll be putting up reading lists.
Chatting about the episodes, laughing at Tom's impersonations.
Or expressing admiration for them. So lots of stuff. And it's very simple to set up. Even we managed to do it.
Now, how much, unfortunately, money has to change hands to join. It's the way with clubs though, isn't it? I mean, you always have to pay to join a club. So how much do people have to pay to join this fantastic club?
A mere £6 per month.
Nothing. Yeah, it's absolutely nothing.
What an ideal Christmas gift that would be.
Restishistorypod.com. That's what you need to know.
Restishistorypod.com. However, just to reiterate, if you don't want to be bothered with any of that, you can carry on listening and you'll get the two episodes as per normal, completely for free every week.
Yeah, but you should join the club anyway. I mean, you really should.
Yes. And now back to the cricket.
Welcome back to The Rest Is History. We are talking about the history of cricket. So we've done rakish origins. We have talked a little bit about the Victorians, and now we're going to look abroad. Now, here is an amazing fact. John, is this true? I read this online. I'm not ashamed to admit I'm reading it on Wikipedia. It says the first ever international cricket match took place between the United States and Canada in 1844. Can that possibly be true?
It is more than true. It's an established fact of the game. Yes, I mean, it's very odd that cricket did have this very brief hold and grip in the United States and Canada, mostly on the eastern seaboard, as you'd expect, and as we'll come to discuss, because the Brits got over there and started playing it. And somehow, and I think no one's really worked out how and why, it loses that grip and in its place comes
baseball. Well, John, you know, when the Pilgrim Fathers go and they have their first Christmas, and there are loads of people who've gone with them who aren't pilgrims, and they all go out to have a prayer on Christmas Day, and they come back and they find that they're playing cricket. These other people are playing cricket, so they confiscate their bat and ball, which I think is where America went wrong in the beginning.
I've heard it
said that it's partly to do with Union soldiers in the American Civil War found it easier to play baseball than cricket, just to play an impromptu game is simpler, and also that it's. When after the American Civil War, that America has a much stronger sense of itself as an alternative to Europe rather than a sort of a descendant of it. So they need their own game. It's part of a kind of American nationalism and stuff.
Yeah, that sounds a bit kind of retrofitted, but
okay.
But I mean, it could be, couldn't it? It could be. It really could be. I mean, I think the interesting thing is that in a lot of places that don't have cricket, there is a game like cricket that has a sense of time and a sort of an internal relationship, a game that you can have an internal, ongoing, long relationship with.
Like baseball,
like,
basically.
Like baseball. I mean, baseball you could hold up as, but I think, you know, a lot of places do have equivalents.
But it's interesting. So America obviously rejects Britain. That's the whole point of it. And so in a sense, as cricket becomes more and more identified with Britain, so it becomes more and more important, I guess, to America to have a sport that is not cricket. The contrast with that is Australia, which is likewise a settler society, but where cricket really does put down massive roots very quickly. We have a question here from, and I think that this touches on all kinds of fascinating issues, from Dan Norcross, who is, of course, a commentator on Test Match Special. Would love you to dwell a little on the Australian Aboriginals tour of England in 1868. The team held its own and was largely well received across the country, apart from York, but returned to Australia penniless, and barely any of them played cricket seriously again. So in 1868, a team of Indigenous Australians are coming over and playing cricket. I mean, that seems amazing.
It does. I mean, I think, we mentioned novelty earlier, and I think that's a factor here. You know, this idea that cricket loves that kind of thing. It's something to come and stare at. It's something that will fill up a day. I think the really, really interesting thing, and you are probably far better qualified to talk about this than I am, about this tour, is that the origin of the species, Darwin, had just come out. It'd been out for, what, I don't know, 10 years or something like that, maybe less than that, when this team arrive. And there's this kind of horrible, now, again, talking retrospectively, sort of goggle-eyed looking at them by the victor, you know, and, horrible, what we would think of now, horrible descriptions in the paper of how they looked, their hair, their beards, you imagine being one of that team and how that must have been.
Well, I mean, the stuff I'm reading here about it, extraordinary. So at the end of the games, they would put on an exhibition of boomerang and spear throwing. Yeah. And a man called, one of them who was called Dicker Dick, would hold a narrow shield and people would pay to throw cricket balls at him.
Yeah.
I mean, that's hard to see that being reintroduced into the game.
No, that's not. See,
but again, this is it's these rich guys trying to fill up their time, isn't it? Yes. Let's go down to Lords. After the game, we'll see you can chuck the ball hardest at him.
But what's fascinating about that, though, is that it's presumably well before Australian national teams are coming over and playing England.
Yeah, well,
and we're doing this against the backdrop of the Ashes that have just started in Australia. But what is it about? So tell us how the Ashes come into being, John, and why it is that England, Australia come to have this kind of epic quality, this titanic quality.
I think purely and simply it's because you could get there. You know, all of a sudden there was by boat, there was a method of going somewhere. And this is why, you know, the whole of cricket exists on these sort of Victorian timescales. You know, it goes on for several days because people had nothing to do and they wanted to go and watch something that lasted for a while. Tours, cricket tours, and the way international cricket is structured is that one country goes off to play a series of matches against another country, and they will stay in that country for several months while they do it, usually. I mean, some tours are slow, but the early tours would last for 6 months. So cricket's a summer game. You have to go somewhere where it's hot to play it. So in the English winter, where do you go? You have to go to the Southern Hemisphere, essentially. So they set sail to Australia. The notion of internationals comes along, again, it's something, you know, WG scores England's first Test Match 100. It arrives, again, a little too late for
what is it that makes a Test Match a Test Match?
But Well, I mean, again, what makes a test match a test match? It's played slightly longer.
For people who know, test matches are international matches.
Test matches are international matches, and they last, and people who don't really come from non-cricket playing countries, because they last for 5 days, people.
Can end in a draw.
Right. And not only do they last for 5 days, there are usually five of them in a series.
Yeah, so, and they break for tea. Yeah, I mean, that will be the thing that will really astound and love overseas listeners.
Yeah. So yes, where does this, you know, this again? I mean, I guess, you know, it's always famously said it's called Test cricket because it is a test. You know, it's the ultimate test of time and skill endurance, and you know, you're in a foreign.
It's really difficult to. Yeah. I mean, you know, if you've played Test cricket, really very difficult to get a Test cricketer out.
Oh, shut up!
Let alone two.
But I don't think they were in their prime when you got them out, were they?
No. They were Test cricketers, Dominic. I got bowled out two Test cricketers. I'm just putting that.
John,
in.
Does he but mention Dominic, this a lot when you're playing in your team?
Yeah, I do. Yes. So let's not talk about it. The notion of international cricket. Should we go back to that?
Yes.
The first England versus Australia becomes the first real contest. They're the first two Test match playing nations. They can test the first Test match. The reason the Ashes becomes famous is that Australia win this encounter terribly free, and it's so destructive to the English vision of themselves. A couple of likely lads take a piss-taking advert in the Times newspaper, saying that. This defeat is so terrible that they've burned the remains of English cricket and put them in this little urn, and that becomes known as the Ashes. The Ashes.
Oh, and what is in the urn?
Well,
I mean, I've seen it. What's in it?
Supposedly. I mean, who knows?
It's
the bales from the game. So in cricket, you have the stumps, which are what the bowlers aim at, and there are three of those. And across the top of the stumps are a couple of smaller bits of wood, which are called the bales, and they have to be knocked off in order for a dismissal to occur.
And this is 1882, isn't it?
This is the first Ashes Test match, yeah. And then the contest is enjoined. It catches the imagination, obviously. And I think Australia winning was a big part of that. I think it was important that Australia won that, because immediately, well, the English, well, you know, we can't have that. We've got to win it back. So the contest, had England sort of won the first 30 Ashes Test matches, incredibly easily. I think, you know, maybe it wouldn't have become the thing it became.
So John, just sticking to the Ashes and the relationship between England and Australia, you could argue that the Ashes kind of channel both an opportunity for Australians to emphasize, you know, to demonstrate that they've emancipated themselves from the mother country, from the kind of, you know, the colonialism that with which Australia had been founded. But at the same time, because cricket is so distinctively English, it enables them to maintain ties as well. I mean, would you say that that's part of the role that cricket has played in Anglo-Australian relations?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's that notion of, you know, I mean, in its simplest form, beating you at your own game, you know, and that's played out not just in England versus Australia. The history of international cricket is the history of empire.
Hold on, Dominic. John, before we come, just specifically on Australia. So the most famous, most notorious Ashes series becomes known as the Bodyline series.
Yes.
And that's in the 1930s.
It's a tremendous name, isn't it? I think whoever came up with that made it historic as well, Bodyline.
Okay, so just tell us about the Bodyline series and why that was... I mean, it was much more than a sporting story. It was a huge crisis in Anglo-Australian relations, and in fact, in the entire fabric of the British Empire.
Yeah, well, after you know, Grace became this defining cricketer, and after Grace, there were lots of really good cricketers. But in the 1920s and 30s, comes along a player called Donald Bradman, who probably even to this day remains sport's greatest outlier. By the statistics, Bradman is...
Of every sport.
By the statistics, Bradman is between 30 and 40% better than anyone else who's ever played cricket.
Better than W.G. Grace?
Yeah. By the statistics. So if we use statistics as a measure, there isn't another sport in which one person has been that far ahead of the field for as long as Bradman was ahead of the field and has remained ahead of the field. So Bradman comes along... immediately begin scoring runs at a rate that no one can has ever seen before. And England's captain, Douglas Jardine, at times, as people know, I think he was actually Scottish, but he comes to represent England and Empire and all of those things because he's the sort of guy you could imagine, you know, plays the national anthem before he goes to bed, you know, he's that
nothing
kind
wrong
of guy.
With that. Completely nothing wrong with that.
I mean, as we all do, obviously. But he goes out to Australia with the aim of winning back the Ashes from Bradman's Australia. And he comes up with a plan to combat Bradman. And that plan is essentially for his bowlers to bowl it as fast as they can at Bradman's head and body. And the cricket ball is, you know, again, if you don't know anything about cricket, the cricket ball is made of leather.
Hard.
It has a cork interior.
It's hard, Dominic.
It's rock hard.
It's very hard.
It's rock hard. And cricket's a dangerous game. People are, you know, the history of cricket is littered with people who've died playing it, partly because the ball was very hard and is propelled towards you at 90 miles an hour from 22 yards away. You don't have a lot of time to get out of the way. And this tactic of Jardine's, slightly more sophisticated than I've described, but essentially it was built around, you know, physical danger and fear. And that goes back to this Victorian moral sense of the game. Is that a legitimate tactic?
Is it cricket?
Yeah. Is it, you
so
know,
they call it leg theory, don't they? Jardine
didn't like it being called, you know, the term body line that's come to represent it. That certainly wasn't his term. His term was leg theory. Again, without giving you a description of how cricket's played, I can't tell you why that makes sense, but it does make sense as a description of what it is. But essentially, it causes an international incident. At government level, body line becomes a problem because by now you've got newsreel footage and people can see this happening that weren't at the grounds. And they see
the kind of ball thudding into the batsman
falling to the ground. And Bradman, who if we give you a kind of really simple overview of what he was doing, Bradman, every time he went into bat, would score around 100 runs, which is a lot of runs in cricket. Well, Jardine's tactic essentially halves that. So Bradman scores around 50 runs per innings.
Just excellent captaincy in my mind.
So really, he just brings Bradman back to everyone's level.
Yeah.
That's what his tactic did.
Why is it such an international incident? I mean, is this genuinely something that governments are kind of concerned about?
Famously, questions were asked in Parliament. Because, you know, at this point, cricket is representing something beyond cricket.
But isn't it? It's also because it's in the 30s. Britain is feeling nervous about the future of the empire. It's under geopolitical threat. Suddenly the Australians are saying there are two sides out there and only one is playing cricket.
Yeah.
That was not a very good Australian accent by your standards, Tom.
No, it wasn't. There are only two sides out there and only one's playing cricket.
Much better. Australia has a sense of national identity post-World War One, doesn't it?
Exactly. It's playing into all that.
Yeah.
And, I mean, Douglas Jardine, even though he's Scottish, embodies for Australians the absolute archetype of a kind of sinister English
arrogant
milord.
Kind of,
there was a brilliant, it wasn't brilliant, but it was a hugely enjoyable drama about it in which he was played by the guy who plays Elrond in Lord of the Rings.
Hugo Weaving.
He's great.
It seems to Australians absolutely indicative of the British class system that he's very posh, and the bowler that he's getting to do this incredibly violent bowling is Harold Larwood. He's been rustled up from a Nottinghamshire coal mine.
He's D.H. Lawrence.
And of course, all the blame ends up being dumped on on Harold Larwood, not on Jardine.
Jardine was unrepentant about it and you know, had that view that it was a legitimate tactic and he just exploited the rules of the game, the laws of the game, which, you know, had been done since time immemorial.
So Australia, it's two predominantly white countries playing one another. In the West Indies, in India, It's different because there are additional dynamics there, which are particularly focused in the West Indies around issues of slavery and race.
Well, I mean, the West Indies, yeah, we should quickly go back to Empire and say, if you look on the map of test playing nations, international cricket nations, although it's a bit bigger now, you might as well have drawn the British Empire on a map, because it's in India and it's in Australia and it's in the West Indies. And it's, but the extraordinary thing about the West Indies is that it doesn't exist. It exists only as a cricket team. It's a collection of autonomous islands. And I think it exists in two forms. It exists as a university. There's a University of West Indies and there's a West Indies cricket team.
Yeah.
But those are the only two places in which it does exist. And yet it comes to represent something enormous to that region, to those people, and to the diaspora as it spreads out. And as, you know, the Windrush generation come to England and make lives here, it assumes huge significance in their lives, and not just as a game of cricket.
And when did the West Indies start playing Test cricket?
Well, they come into it in, you know, when most of these others start coming along. England and Australia play away together for 20 or 30 years, and then you get the West Indies coming along.
Right.
And so you're talking about the early part of the last century. And then by the 1950s, you've also got Pakistan and you've got India, and then Sri Lanka join even later than that. And so over the course of the century, all of these places come and join and start playing cricket.
Do you think that it's quite a kind of complicated dynamic, isn't it? Because it's not just so for the British associate cricket with their own civilization. It's a marker of their, you know, their values, their kind of everything that they see the British Empire at its best as embodied.
Teamwork, sportsmanship, all those things.
And so therefore for, say, you know, the planters in the Caribbean, or for Maharajas in India, it's a way of basically kind of sucking up to the British. It's a way of kind of aligning themselves with the values of the colonial power. But then that enables the roots to be put down. But then it gets taken up by people, by the kind of the masses, and becomes a way of kind of fighting back against British claims to supremacy. And the West Indies is the most kind of dramatic illustration of that, because, you know, the roots of cricket in the Caribbean do go back to a time where you have, you know, where the slave period, and where, you know, slaves are being employed to clear the sugar cane to make cricket grounds.
Yeah.
And that kind of class thing that you get in England, where it's the batsmen who are the aristocrats and it's the bowlers who are the kind of the peasantry. In the Caribbean, it's even more kind of dramatic. And that you know, slaves are being employed basically to bowl at the masters, which is why increasingly, you know, they bowl faster and faster and faster to try and make the masters hop. And so that's kind of, you know, the tradition of fast bowling in the West Indies that you still get. But of course, to stand at the wicket and to smack around white bowlers for a black batsman, again, I mean, it's an incredible...
It's, yeah, it amazingly symbolic, isn't it? You know, that's the, I mean, this, and also for...
Can I quote you a line from The Wailers?
Yeah.
Slave driver, the table is turned. Catch a fire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But isn't there that famous moment in the 1970s when the England captain, what is his name?
Tony Greig.
He says he wants to make the West Indies grovel. And there's this huge furore, isn't there? Because that scene is basically...
He's South African. Although he's captain of England, he's South African.
A rhetorical kind of reassertion of the old master-slave dynamic. I mean, that's maybe a bit harsh on Tony Greig, but that's exactly how it's interpreted.
Well, that's one of the hugely significant times in West Indies cricket. The first is probably, you say, in 1950 was when they first beat England in a test match. And the first time that all of the other test-playing nations beat England in a test match takes on an extraordinary significance for them. That plays out through the history of the game. But then, yeah, come the 1970s, and that tour that you're talking about happened in 1976, the summer of 1976 in England, which is, you know, as you all know, Dominic, it was the time of punk rock. It was the time of garbage in the streets and, you know, all of this stuff's going on.
James Callaghan is.
Yeah. Yeah,
glad we got him in.
Yeah. A backdrop to all
Jesus
of that.
And James Callaghan.
And here come this cricket team. And this was the first time I ever went to a test match as a little kid. Here come this West Indies cricket team. and they are like gods. I mean, they are like gods among men. They bowl faster. They hit the ball further. They're incredibly athletic in the field. They're playing a new kind of cricket that no one's seen before. I mean, it begins a revolution in the game. And they're sort of summed up by the man who becomes their leading batsman, Viv Richards, who's this incredibly, yeah, his nickname was Smoking Joe because he looked a bit like Joe Frazier, and he had that kind of boxer's physique, incredible Roman nose, and he carried himself with such.
He's my absolute hero.
You know, yeah, and mine, and I think, yeah, the amazing thing that team did, certainly for me and for a lot of people, is it just made it impossible to think of West Indies and West Indies as anything other than brilliant, superior beings.
Yeah.
Because they were just you know, like the England team at that time were led by Tony Greig, who was as I say, a South African, but was a 6'7" sort of beanpole guy who ran in a strange way and batted in a strange way. They had David Steele in the team, who was grey-haired, in his 30s, wore glasses.
Kind of John Major, didn't he?
He was known as the bank clerk who went to war. They had Derek Underwood as a spin bowler who sort of looked like an Oxford Don. You know, he's prematurely bowled, his feet splayed out when he ran. And you're comparing them to these these guys who are like, they must have looked at the England team and thought, what is this?
Yeah. But then if we're talking about emblematic figures, right, I mean, if you fast forward just a little bit, you have somebody who I would see as one of the absolutely most sort of richly emblematic figures of British life in my lifetime, a British kind of political and cultural life. And that is Lord Botham of Brexit. So Ian Botham, working class conservative, Thatcherite. And then later on, a hugely outspoken Eurosceptic and a sort of.
And was going to be James Bond, wasn't he, Dominic?
He was going to be James Bond.
And a personification. Right, of a kind of Georgian Englishness that I think has reasserted itself in the last few decades.
Also, let us say, in fairness to Lord Botham of Brexit, Viv Richards' best friend.
Yeah, exactly, which is really interesting.
Yeah, and early teammate, they famously shared a flat together.
So a sort of populist hero, basically.
A populist hero who comes along and never defeats the West Indies, in fairness. West Indies are too good even for both of them.
Well, he always fails against them. But, I mean, he can never do anything against.
But he does slay Australia and he does reassert English dominance in the Ashes, which makes him into this folk hero.
Yeah, so John, I think it's the friendship between Botham and Richards, England's greatest, West Indies' greatest batsman, is a reminder that cricket can, you know, it's not just about kind of racial oppression.
No,
and
I mean,
you know, it's about friendship. However, I mean, it is against the backdrop of kind of recent scandals involving racism in accusations of racism at Yorkshire in particular, with South Asian players. I think we should look at the role that cricket plays in, because we're running out of time. We should look at the role that cricket has played in India, in Pakistan, and perhaps the role that it plays within racial dynamics in England now, because basically cricket now is fundamentally an Indian sport rather than an English one. Would you say that's an exaggeration?
Oh, no, not at all. Yeah, India is the heart of the game now. It's the financial centre of the game.
Cultural centre.
But it's also this, where the soul of the game is, because the population is so obsessed with cricket in a way that we're not in England, and increasingly they're not in the West Indies anymore. The Australians are, but obviously they're a much smaller population. India is where the soul of the game is now.
And there was a question, I can't actually see it on the list we've got, but there was somebody asked a question. Do you think that India against Pakistan in cricket is the biggest sporting fixture in the world?
I do. Well, one thing I would mention really quickly before that, I know we haven't got loads of time, but it was a game, again, that I was at as a young lad, and it was the 1983 World Cup final.
Which they've just made a film about.
They have just made a film about, which was India versus the West Indies. And this was the moment at which, if you were saying there was a moment at which India began to emerge as the centre of the game that we're talking about, it was at this game when, as massive underdogs, they defeated West Indies, who had been at that point twice champions. There were a tremendously symbolic moment when Kapil Dev, the Indian captain, caught out Viv Richards from a high steepling catch, and you know, the whole of Lord's holding its breath as this ball falls to earth, and Kapil holds the catch and dismisses the great Richards. And this is the moment at which India comes out.
A new India is born.
Well, before then, there's no doubt, and there is no doubt, and I don't know how to say this in the right way, really. There was a kind of cultural cringe in India, a kind of feeling amongst Indians that they were somehow, you know, beneath still the hand of empire. And this was a moment, I think, when actually that began to lift and they got it, you know, underneath Kapil, they all stood up, their chests puffed out, and they began to think, hang on, you know, we're a serious cricket team here. We're a serious force. And that's the moment. That's the moment it happens. And it starts to build and build. And, you know, obviously, India-Pakistan is always going to be a ferocious rivalry. Pakistan come along in 1992 and win the World Cup. And that becomes a moment for them under Imran Khan. Imran Khan, who is now the president of Pakistan, was the captain of the Pakistan cricket team. So you can probably see how important the link is between cricket and the rest of society in Pakistan. But the India-Pakistan relationship is always played out under India's power. So India, for example, now has the most famous cricket league in the world, which is called the Indian Premier League, and it doesn't allow Pakistani players in it. That's the one nation they don't allow.
But that's why when India meet Pakistan in international cricket contests, that's why it's so huge, isn't it?
And why in the recent World Cup, when Pakistan beat India, actually crushed India, it was such a, you know, there was glee around the world because everyone likes to see the, you know, the bully get a black eye. And that was what Pakistan inflicted. But yeah, I mean, we could have another 3 hours on why Pakistan and India is such a contest. But yes, it is.
Well, maybe we should save that for later then.
We definitely should.
John, I mean, one final question. I mean, we've been talking about kind of international cricket, professional cricket, the great stars of cricket. But I mean, you know, cricket continues to be played by amateurs as well.
For God's sake.
It does.
And I wonder, is there a particular innings, perhaps even a particular shot,
a moment
played by an amateur player?
Please, John, answer this.
That has a kind of historic
very
resonance.
Carefully about the answer that the listeners will want to hear.
A mythological resonance.
You see, this has so come to infect my mind so often as it's been repeated. I mean, I would say that, yeah, amateur cricket. Let's first of all, a really quick analogy. If you imagine an iceberg that's sort of 10% above the surface of the water, the 10%, that's the professional game. The 90% under the water is guys like us who like to play, guys and girls like who like to play at the weekend and play amateur cricket very badly. In the context of playing amateur cricket incredibly badly, you can still have triumph and disaster.
Can you think of one particular one maybe that's been photographed?
And really, this is a tale of the social media age, I think, in that Tom's one great moment
great moment is probably a bit much, isn't it?
Dominic, you don't know about cricket.
But you know, you talk about symbolic resonance, Dominic. We're talking about the playing fields of Eton. I mean, where else, if you were going to strike the one shot of your life,
so
where
we should explain, shouldn't we, to listeners, that this is I hit a six, and a six is where you hit the ball so hard, so well,
or so luckily
that it goes over the kind of boundary rope which contains the cricket pitch.
I was thinking about when I was toying with how to introduce this podcast, and I went with my Sir Henry Newbolt poem.
Yes.
The alternative, which I had tracked down this morning, was one of the Greyfriars school stories in which, by a stroke of extraordinary chance, Billy Bunter, the fat owl of the remove, hits a six. And I thought, I won't read that out because that's a bit mean to Tom to compare him to Billy Bunter.
No, not at all.
But now I wish I had.
No, not at all. Because the point is, it's not just that I hit it, but that it was photographed. Listeners who want to know this, I will make sure to include it on my Twitter feed.
The narcissism of the Instagram age.
That's exactly what it is. I mean,
playing the game, playing up the game. As you have done, John, can't thank you enough. I think it is time to...
On that bombshell.
Draw stumps.
Draw stumps. Take the bales. Retire to the pub. Thanks very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Enjoy the Ashes if you like cricket. I hope that some of this has made sense. If you don't,
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.